So what you have to understand in this industry is that regulatory requirements plays a huge role. And what would take 3 months in another industry to integrate is easily an 18-month road by peer, even getting used to sort of the hypercare phase for your scale up and start monetization. And so in your business plan, just add a whole lot more runway than you thought you would need.
Hey, this is Jesse here, and you're about to hear the quarterly Investor Vibe Check episode, where we welcome a panel of respected industry investors to look back on the last 3 months. This time around, we welcomed Robin Reed, Connor Williams, and Andrew Ehrenberg, and it was another can't-miss discussion. The panel discussed a very busy Q1 that saw a flurry of early-stage funding announcements, including a number of strategic investments into B2B startups. We also discussed some of the themes that came out of the recently released Game Changers report, including the challenges for B2B startups selling into operators, and the disconnect between startup fundraising and revenue generation. This was an excellent discussion that hit across a number of additional areas, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. The Betting Startups podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming market. 4 out of the top 5 US operators personalize player experiences with Optimove. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/bettingstartups. And if you like what you see, you'll get your first month free. All right, we are back with episode 110 of the Betting Startups podcast, which so happens to be our quarterly Investor Vibe Check episode. We all ostensibly survived yesterday's solar eclipse, which means we're back to prognosticate on the state of the industry's early stage ecosystem with 3 respected industry investors. This time around, I'm really pumped to welcome today's panel, which spans not only 3 time zones, but I think 3 different accents, so should be a really well-rounded discussion. Joining us are, in alphabetical order, Andrew Ehrenberg from Eberg Capital, Connor Williams from Velo Partners, and Robin Reed from happyhour.io. Let's just start here with a quick round of introductions. We'll go around, and if you could just briefly introduce yourselves, quickly speak to your background in the industry, share a bit of detail about your firm's investment profile or areas of focus, and if you want to name drop any notable portfolio companies you wish to call out, feel free. We'll go alphabetically by first name. So Andrew, over to you to get us started here.
Awesome. Thanks, Jesse. So I'm Andrew Ehrenberg. I'm a partner at Eberg Capital. We invest early stage, particularly at the intersection of emerging sports betting applications and the commercialization of alternative sports. Some notable companies in that vein are Better, Alt Sports Data, Pro League Network, Slamball, WagerWire, a number of others. And so we started our firm about 2 years ago. My dad comes from a successful tech venture capital background, and I come from a data and product management background, and my brother is currently doing his master's in sports management at Columbia. So it's really a family shop, all off our own balance sheet. And we have about 50 million of capital deployed in the space as of today, and looking forward to continue to expand our portfolio and our perspective.
All right, Connor, over to you next for introduction, please.
Great. Thanks, Jesse. Glad to be here. So we are seed in Series A gaming and gambling at our core. We've been at it for 15 years now. We have an AUM of around $900 million. Within that, we have 4 unicorns, 1 exited being Evolution, 2 in the gaming space being Moon Active and Triple Dot, and another one that is sort of more kind of low key at the moment. We've also got a number of portfolio companies that are north of 500 million. And we're kind of unique in how we approach things in that we're a permanent capital vehicle. So we deliberately set ourselves up that way to kind of address some of the pitfalls that we foresaw in the VC model. You know, we're kind of deploying at a rate faster than we've done in a number of years. We've sort of been averaging around 5 or 6 exits the last 2 or 3 years. So yeah, really wrapping things up again at the moment.
Awesome. And then last but not least, Robin.
Pleasure to meet you guys. Robin, I'm working with happyhour.io. We are a early stage and seed fund investor, all the way from incubation, basically, to Series A. What's unique about us is that the whole team is online gambling entrepreneurs ourselves. We've done it, built successful companies. We know what it takes. And we are now looking to source people specifically within the casino space, where we look at emerging technologies, immersive technologies. We'll talk more about it, real-time experiences, these things. So approximately 150 million assets under management. That's grown from a few million only a few years ago when we started the company. So it's been a hell of a journey, and great to be on the podcast, Jesse.
All right, guys. Appreciate the introductions. With that out of the way, let's just get right into things. So we're looking back on Q1 of 2024 here. Somehow we're already in April. We got a full quarter under our belts already. And in Q1, we had more early stage funding announcements than any other quarter, which, if I'm not mistaken, includes new and or follow-on investments from all three of your respective firms. And punctuating this point, actually, just this morning, my inbox received the latest edition of the Startup Month from the Earnings and More newsletter, which basically echoed this point, which is that Q1 2024 had more announced fundings since they started tracking them back in 2022. So I guess just to start off, guys, it'd be great to get your perspectives on what you each make of this increase in activity. And I guess, how does this reconcile to what you're seeing within your firm on a day-to-day basis? And to get us started here, we'll go in reverse alphabetical order. So Robin, maybe we can start with you, please.
So our firm has sort of engaged in transactions over the last couple of years. It was tough, I think, in 22 and early start of 23 to work particularly on exits. There wasn't the same appetite in the IPO market. There wasn't the same appetite in private transactions. However, that has changed. I think something happened when OpenAI released ChatGPT, and NVIDIA came with a mother of all earnings reports a while back. And if you see now, stock market valuations are at peak. The capital markets are way better than they used to be. And I think that trickles down into, you know, private equity markets, all different financial instruments. There's just an appetite in the market. And I think we see that in our category and sector as well.
Awesome. How about for yourselves, Connor?
Yeah, sure. So I think going top down, I think that we don't necessarily see there being a major structural shift from, say, last year from a macro sense. Certainly a lot of the blue chip sort of generalist funds that we work with that are kind of managing multi-billion portfolios are taking that view. In fact, if anything, a lot of them are actually trying not to deploy at the moment. I think that what we're seeing in this quarter is likely more of a hangover of a number of startups trying to delay as much as they could their fundraisers last year, as Robin sort of alluded to, being a function of kind of 2 years sort of looking back from there of really bad markets. And I think what we're seeing now is a lot of what's funding is essentially folks that can't wait any longer. Kind of dovetailing into that, we are seeing a lot of unannounced bridge rounds and down rounds, particularly in the space. So I think that number is probably a significant understatement of the actual amount that was raised. But, you know, if I was to crystal ball gaze, I wouldn't guess that Q2 is going to have kind of a similar uplift as what we're seeing in Q1 now.
I'm building on what Connor just said. I think a lot of founders that were out raising money in 21 and 22 have had a little bit of a come to Jesus moment in terms of getting the capital they need for their business to survive, especially at the early stage. So I think to that point, there's been a lot of unannounced rounds, but there's also been announced rounds that have kind of been in that down round to flat round to extension rounds category. And as a firm, one of the things we've been really focused on is doubling down on the founders and the businesses inside of our own portfolio that we feel and maintain strong conviction in, but have not been able to garner the support in the market that they initially looked for. But some of them have actually been able to gain some additional support at lower, more realistic valuations. So I think that adjustment has stimulated the markets as well. And I know there's other drivers, but that's definitely been important for us.
Awesome. Yeah. And just to sort of extend upon some of the points you guys made, I think I heard a recent podcast on the Next.io podcast with Lloyd Danzig, who commented something to the effect of like the last, I think, 10 or so investments his firm made. Of those 10, only one of those has actually announced their funding round. So it seems like there actually might be a lot more happening behind the scenes and out of the headlines than otherwise might be suggested. So let's segue a little bit as well to, you know, another thing I saw and observed in Q1, which was a handful of strategic investments into early stage companies in the space. We saw Light and Wonder making an investment into Flows, which is a portfolio company of Happy Hour of Robin's. We also saw OpenBet taking a stake in Strive, Aristocrat taking a stake in Connectify. And I guess I'm just wondering, taking all this together, guys, you know, how do you see these large B2B suppliers insofar as, you know, what they're looking to these startups for to drive innovation? And I guess more importantly, can we expect to see more of this? Just sort of how do you, I guess, reconcile what to me seems to be a bit of a rush of, you know, incumbents ultimately taking positions in some of the more promising early stage companies. And Andrew, we'll start with you on this one, if we may.
I think this is something we're thinking a lot about in our early stage portfolio in terms of aligning interests with operators and leagues and things of that nature. We've definitely seen an uptick in interest in that. And I think part of that is operators wanting to establish some sort of first mover advantage towards implementing some sort of technology, and with extensive roadmap backlogs associated with building things in-house, sometimes it makes more sense to effectively invest without acquiring or just simply buying software. That there's kind of this middle ground of creating a strategic investment relationship in the earlier days of a company's life cycle that has allowed certain B2B operators to do that.
I think the interesting thing here is that we're starting to see B2Bs do what B2Cs have actually done for a while. I mean, if I think of, you know, Intan has done one or two sort of minority B2C investments in the last few years. We've done quite a few investments like that with Betway in particular, Supergroup. And I think it's a fairly well-worn road on the B2C side. I think the interesting thing on the B2B side is that they kind of have to be tech-first businesses, right? That's often what they're essentially selling into B2Cs. I will do something better than you can do yourself. And the reality is, as those tech stacks age, they have to find an advantage that they can essentially sell into these B2Cs. So often what ends up happening, and Sportradar, for example, are famous for doing this, is some sort of commercial partnership whereby these B2Bs almost become agents of these investments that they make. I think it also makes strategic sense for them in that they're getting the inside corner and essentially a free option on acquiring some potentially interesting tech without having to take the risk up front. Again, particularly for the listed B2Bs, that's a lot more palatable than trying to sell your shareholders on why you're dropping 50 mil on something that's barely got any revenue. And yeah, I think it's a double-edged sword, quite frankly. We often encourage our portfolio companies not to take B2B funding, particularly early. And the main reason for that is a lot of the time it starts to limit what your exit potential will look like, especially when the B2Bs can poison the well, if you will. And the other side of that is often their competitors will be a lot more reluctant to take commercial positions with you if you have a large competitor of theirs on the cap table.
I'd like to go bigger picture on this. And I came into the industry in 2003 when Chris Moneymaker won the World Series and poker was the big thing. And as a player myself, I've been observing this industry for 20 years now. If you look at sort of what is the key drivers and the dynamic shifts, online gambling or iGaming is based upon technological acceleration. And that is the first and most important dynamic shifts, which leads to new consumer behaviors that ultimately leads to regulators responding. And if you look at what's especially happened over the last 7-8 years in our industry, there has been a lot of regulation, and the larger companies are meeting that by consolidating and by acquiring companies, which means that they get stuck in a regulatory quagmire where they're busy with their integration roadmaps, they're busy with acquiring companies, they're busy meeting regulatory standards. They're trying to reach economies of scale, so they're trying to sort of mitigate the margin squeeze that comes with increased taxation and so forth, which means that they're suffering from an innovation perspective. And nowhere is that more true than in the B2B space, where pipelines, you know, 6, 12, 24 months is not unheard of. It's long lead times, it's hard to get through the door, it's long integration queues, backlogs, and so forth. It's hard for the larger B2B players to focus on innovation that you typically see in other industries, which leaves an opportunity for startups and for companies like ours that are investing into startups to help these get through the hard initial phase where you need to have enough funding, where you need to have enough runway to get to the maturity you need. Now, that obviously means that there is quite an opportunity in bridging these two worlds, in sort of doing the innovation that the larger B2B companies might identify and need themselves, but where they simply don't have the bandwidth or the focus from management to do so. If you take the example of Foz, for instance, I think that's precisely what happened. It's a great company that can accelerate technology and solve a lot of the pain points that the whole value chain of iGaming have. And a company like Light & Wonder really needs that. And it was a conversation going for quite a while and a perfect fit. And it's been great for both companies, I think.
Awesome. Well, I think I've heard all three of you make reference now to, you know, for B2B companies, the integration timelines and the roadmaps. We'll come back to that in a few minutes and do a bit of a deep dive on that topic. But just to sort of put a stamp on Q1, one other quick topic I'd love to touch upon is M&A, a couple deals that were very hard to ignore. And what I want to focus on is M&A specifically by operators, right? So the two deals I'll call out here under this umbrella is DraftKings acquisition of Jackpocket, obviously, you know, a behemoth of a deal, and every take that there is to be made about it, I think has happened at this point, but obviously a juggernaut of a deal. And then sort of alongside that, we had FanDuel acquiring BeyondPlay, which I thought was quite an interesting deal. And quick shout out to Carolina Pelk, who is to me, and I've said this before on the podcast, who may well be the single most impressive founder and entrepreneur I've had the pleasure of talking to in 100 plus episodes. So, you know, I wasn't surprised to see BeyondPlay get picked up, other than maybe for me anyways, it wasn't so obvious it would be FanDuel. All that being said, guys, I'm curious what your individual analyses are of operators making acquisitions like this, and like what's driving these deals, and particularly of interest to other startups listening to this episode that are very much trying to understand how they could potentially position themselves for something similar down the line. Connor, can we start with you on this one, please?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So I suppose starting with DraftKings one, which is slightly more of a, you know, existential acquisition. I think that a lot has been said, particularly about the valuation and whether they paid too much. I think our view is ultimately what they've bought is a category leader. There are obviously competitors in the Korean lottery space, but, you know, without a doubt, Jackpocket is the outright leader. I think it makes a lot of sense, particularly in the context of a much slower casino rollout in the US. I think DraftKings has to strategically be able to point to medium-term growth within that business. They've made it very clear that they do not want to go and find that growth outside of the US. And I think, therefore, starting to move into categories like lottery couriering makes a lot of sense. And I wouldn't be surprised if ultimately we look back in a few years and say that actually it was a pretty fair price that they paid. Then moving on to FanDuel's acquisition. So I think that's a slightly different kettle of fish, in that I think FanDuel are clearly, as are DraftKings, as are all the sort of top fives, they're looking for tech leadership and they're looking for an edge in an exceptionally competitive market, right? The days of the land grab are coming to an end. Profitable unit economics have to be delivered. And now it's all about finding efficiencies and about finding competitive edges. Typically, an edge starts to look like a product advantage in some shape or form. Now, I think going ahead and buying what is essentially a sort of social spin on a casino product makes a lot of sense for a number of reasons for FanDuel, particularly when they're trying to go after younger demographics. I think the upside of that is, as you sort of alluded to, I think Carolina is a rock star founder. So I think, you know, as well as buying the tech, they get a free option on probably one of the strongest founders in the industry. You know, and I think the team she's built around her is also really strong. So if anything, they've got that acqui-hire to fall back on if, you know, everything doesn't go according to plan A. And I think we're seeing a lot more of these. I don't want to say necessarily that these are the sort of incumbents starting to harvest the overfunding of the industry, but, you know, I think this is definitely, to my mind, a tech play with an option on a really strong founder to potentially build into your leadership team.
Awesome. Robin, we'll swing over to you to follow up on that.
Yeah, just first to follow on the point with B2B that I mentioned, also on the B2C side, you see that some of these businesses have now grown to be multi-billion companies, and if you can provide them with innovation that even sort of skews their KPIs more percentage points in a positive direction, that has huge value in that size of scale, right? So it makes perfect sense. Now, when it comes to that acquisition specifically, then we also exited a company called Lightspins. We sold it to Evolution Gaming. It was too early to sell the company because it was very early stage and had great KPIs and great development, but we got a very, very good earnout and decided it was better to team up with them to realize the full potential of the business. And it's a very similar product as to BeyondPlay and what Carolina is building. And so the underlying sort of fundamental there goes back to what I said about technological acceleration and user behavior. So when we believed in that and took a stake, was because we saw how initially sort of the online and what do you call it, real life worlds were diverging. But over time, they've been converging. People are looking for that authenticity in their online life as well. And if you take e-commerce, for instance, now Taobao, which is the eBay of China, is selling 1/3 of their products through live stream shopping, right? So the Kim Kardashian type influencers trying a lipstick on and people chatting and buying right there and then off the stream. And we thought that that level of reliability has to come to the games of chance iCasino market as well, where People are simply tired of downloading a slash or HTML file and sitting in their solitude at home and playing a game. And, you know, they want to be in the stream. They want to be in the entertainment right now. They want to be in the chat meeting other users, all the technological opportunities that that leads to in terms of gamification and whatnot. So we think that space is super interesting and super hard. Carolina sent the deck to me back in August 2020. She's worked a long time. She deserves it. And I think good luck and bless her on making that sale to Sanju. That's my comment there. On Jackpot, Gut, and DraftKings, we had a prediction panel in iGaming Next in Valletta in 2022, where we discussed DraftKings buying social casino, but we're much the same rationale there. I think it is about user acquisition and access to new demographics, and we predicted that one, and I think it is a great acquisition.
Not a ton to add there. I think the wealth of experience this in this room already summed it up, but I think that just in short, you have operators who are often looking to get a head start on some new product or innovation, and are, whether it's buying a new PAM or buying a social betting application or buying a new betting engine, are looking to refresh and accelerate their technological innovation without having to build in-house, where in the context of a much larger organization, you are not able to achieve that speed to market without achieving some kinds of these acquisitions. And also to the point of acqui-hiring, you have these agile, startup-oriented, innovative teams who are developing and iterating at a much faster pace. So often acquiring these teams and these leaders makes a lot of sense.
Awesome, guys. Well, we'll pin Q1 there. I want to spend the next few minutes here on a couple of topics related to a recent report. I'm going to shamelessly plug some of my own work here for a moment. Last month, I published the Game Changers report, which was a 23-page report that was a result of a survey I sent out, and 68 industry startups responded to the survey. At least by my assessment, I don't think that breadth of data has been collected from startups in this industry ever. You know, I had 68 startups report on everything from their revenue, their EBITDA, their funding backgrounds, and a lot of the sensitive stuff that you don't normally get disclosed. So it was quite an insightful look, to say the least. And thematically, there was a few things in that report that really jumped out to me that I'd love to get your guys' takes on. So we'll quickly go through a couple topics as it relates to the Game Changers report, which, by the way, was released in partnership with the team at Next.io. Have a quick look in the show notes of this episode for a link to the report. It's free. First topic though, guys, as I said, we've been talking a little bit in this conversation around some of the frustrations that B2B startups have had with respect to operator and or platform integration timelines. And in some of my conversations I've been having recently, I've actually sort of experienced the opposite, where I'm getting some anecdotes suggesting that operators in particular are actually now starting to prioritize external integrations, perhaps now more than ever since PASPA's repeal within a US market context. So I guess I'm just trying to reconcile all of this and get your guys' assessment, especially given that each of you has B2B startups and challenger brands in your respective portfolios. What's your assessment, I guess, on just the whole integration roadmap conundrum? And I guess, what counsel are you providing to your B2B portfolio companies as it relates to that? And I guess that you would provide any B2B startup trying to get on an operator or a platform's roadmap. And Andrew, we'll start with you on this one, if we may.
It's almost hard to explain, but I've definitely seen, just anecdotally, a huge uptick in interest from operators who are actually looking to take the next step and run POCs and run experiments with some of our B2B companies. And that's been exciting to see. I think perhaps there's, with the increased focus on responsible gaming and the desire to expand to new markets and offer new sports and new contests, and just as, you know, you're even seeing the market shares of FanDuel and DraftKings starting to converge, and you have new operators like Fanatics and ESPN Bet entering the market. And with all of those kind of new factors at play and the kind of flattening of the competition, you're seeing more of a desire for interesting new products that operators couldn't otherwise build themselves. And in terms of the long, I mean, I still think it's quite a grind to get on a roadmap. I don't think that's changed, but we're definitely seeing more interest. But I guess the advice I'm offering to these founders is to be patient and be conservative with their cash burn, because just with the understanding that these deals, even as they continue to move forward, will take some time. And even once you get to an LOI or get to actual integration contracts, you're still probably 3 to 6 months out from any material movement and then another few months from realizing revenue, especially if it's a percentage of GGR rather than some sort of upfront integration fee. So definitely patience is an important virtue here and being hyper conservative and as pessimistic as possible while still pushing forward.
Sort of if you read the state of the game, I think what's happening in the US is just what we saw in Europe happening. And you know, when PASPA got repelled and companies started coming out gunning for market share, then obviously they had to raise capital. And part of the credibility of the companies was owning the tech stack, right? They had to own the mission critical tech. They had to appoint the key partners and make those decisions in their playbook. Now, as they developed or acquired and integrated all of that technology, they then also have to maintain the technology. And there is a lot. You're going to be multi-vertical, you're going to be in many states, you're going to be a technology company, a marketing company, an operator. There is a lot to take on. So we've naturally now progressed to a point where what isn't mission critical, what is more peripheral to your operation is perhaps something you might want to look at outsourcing in order to stay nimble and experimental. And that's what we advise our startups to do, to not look at, you know, don't try to, lease a pan to DraftKings at 4%. You know, it will never, ever happen. But see what technology they might need that they don't have in their priority pipeline right now to develop in-house. And perhaps you can build something that you can prove is valuable, accretive to them. And ultimately, they're much larger scale and you would have created value, you know, for the whole ecosystem.
Anything you want to add there, Connor?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's a game that we've been playing for 15 years. The old, you know, the tier one being integrated is around the corner and then the product manager leaves or whatever it may be. I think Robin hit the nail on the head about why in the US in particular, we're seeing slightly more appetite than in Europe at the moment. I think it's absolutely because, particularly in the case of DraftKings and FanDuel, the sell no longer has to be for the tech multiples. The sell can now be for the unit economics and the profit story. Similar to that, you know, I think it also depends on the business itself. You know, if I think of, say, for example, Odin, who are the leading esports odds provider that we're invested in. When I think back sort of 3 years ago to when we invested, they sort of had 10, let's say 10 customers, and they just signed Betway as their first tier one. They'd been on that journey north of 5 years. Fast forward to where they are now, and basically every tier one operator and their donkey is trying to get on Odin's integration map. And, you know, their integration times have easily more than halved as a result. So unfortunately, as much as operators will tell you every B2B provider is treated equally, when it's a case that they really do want something, people do kind of get shifted forward in the queue. So it's a tough one. You know, I think Andrew touched on it. You need to be very mindful of cash conservation. As I touched on earlier, we deliberately set ourselves up as a permanent capital vehicle so that we could take these long-term views with some of these B2Bs. There's been a number of them that we've had to entirely recapitalize, for example, and are still alive and kicking today. You have Betametrics, who recently did their Series A with Better Capitals, is a good example of that. But even though the operators are broadly more open to integrations than they used to be, I think timing is still a major, major issue in the B2B startup ecosystem.
Jesse, I'd just like to extend on that what Connor is saying, because an advice to startups, not only the ones in our portfolio, but in general, is mostly everyone I speak with, they are greatly underestimating the time frames. So what you have to understand in this industry is that regulatory requirements plays a huge role. And what would take 3 months in another industry to integrate is easily an 18-month road by peer, even getting used to sort of the hypercare phase for your scale up and start monetization. And so in your business plan, just add a whole lot more runway than you thought you would need.
Yeah, I guess one other thing to add on to this is sometimes as a B2B operator, you need to go after the smaller revenue opportunity first to get to the larger one. Where if you look at the case of Joey Levy, SimpleBet, now, you know, he's onto Better, but the way that Joey got his early success from SimpleBet was by partnering with a Greek lottery operator called Intralot, kind of a famous story at this point, but he was able to get the data and the case study he needed to then turn around and go to the tier one operators in the United States and show them how they could see this increasing GGR in the future. But with it all being theoretical, it wasn't a compelling enough story, even if it was interesting. So even if it's just in WagerWire right now is actually going through a very similar struggle where we just partnered with RT Sports, a smaller DFS pick'em operator, and now have live bet trading available, and we've been able to demonstrate some really interesting data. And I think we're getting a lot more interest from the tier one operators as a result. And it's really aided in those conversations. So one piece of advice for me would be to, if you need to start small, just to kind of tell the story, then start small and tell the story, and don't have too much ego about it.
Speaking of runway, which you touched upon there in that last topic, another theme that came out of the Game Changers report to me was just the massive disconnect between the cumulative funding between the startups that responded to the survey. So just for context and as a data point, the 68 startups reported cumulative funding in excess of $250 million. So we're talking a quarter of a billion, but you know, 69% of those companies reported doing less than 500K in top line revenue in 2023. So, you know, for me, this suggests a couple things, one of which is that one's ability to raise capital doesn't necessarily translate directly into business results. But maybe more importantly, what I'm curious to hear from your guys' perspectives is, how do you guys as investors interpret this gap between funding and reported revenue? And sort of what do you, I guess, generally make of it, sort of seeing this data? And Connor, maybe we can start with you on this one.
Sure. So I think, look, and this is not only true of our industry, but I think of VC as a whole. The last few years have been massively overfunded as a result of structural issues like near zero interest rates and quantitative easing all over the shop. I don't think at this point anyone's debating whether venture capital in general was overfunded. And certainly, you know, our industry was not an exception to that. I think that the other thing that's always worth bearing in mind is that, you know, on average, if a VC is thinking about their investor profile, you know, I think they're thinking they've done really well if two of their 10 investments are successful, if they're going pretty early, you know, it's particularly if you're swinging big. And it's not a surprise to me that when you're looking at it in an absolute number term, you're seeing that. I think probably a more interesting way to look at it would actually be to sort of substrate it into 10 percentiles and actually have a look at what the upper 10 percentiles doing in terms of revenue. I would imagine, as is the case with all venture industries, it's probably massively outsized compared to the average kind of sort of underachievers, if you want to call that. So I think, yes, there has been overfunding, but I think at the same time, the model isn't such that, you know, you even have a 50% graduation rate per se. So it does make sense that you have a large number of startups who are struggling to find product market fit, particularly given the fact that the vast majority of those are US focused, right? So a lot of them are going after the same meal.
Awesome. Robin?
I think iGaming, we have successfully rebranded online gambling, iGaming, I guess. I think our industry is a bit peculiar and special in the sense that, you know, if you're an investor, if you're a financial investor in most industries, you would understand the products you're investing into. I mean, if you invest in a fitness app and you do some workouts, you have an idea of what sort of innovation they're bringing. And I want to criticize both sort of the entrepreneurs and the investors in our industry a bit here, because I do think that a lot of the capital that has come into the iGaming industry doesn't necessarily understand the product. I really like something Lloyd Danzig says, which is, I want to invest into something I want to play myself. And that's sort of the philosophy that we have applied. And we definitely have a far, far, far better ratio than this. And I think on the founder side as well, I think more humble founders are required. I think a lot of people are coming in with high valuations and they don't understand the impact of technological change, of regulatory change, of consumer behavior change, and how street smart you need to be to traverse and navigate that landscape, and how valuable it is to have investors that can actually help you navigate that terrain. And some of these people are coming in, you know, guns blazing and asking for high valuations. They're brilliant business idea. They were compelling, were believable. When it comes down to actually making choices, you know, it's like a ruler, right? If you make a wrong choice, you end up here instead of ending up far up here. And every little decision along the way gets you there, how fast you scale. And sort of the advice you can get from an experienced capital partner is often underestimated. So I think it goes both ways. I think we need to come closer at understanding each other, put in much more work in understanding the environment we're in from both sort of buy and sell side.
Yeah, I think part of this also builds on the previous question, where a lot of, especially B2B companies in this industry, take a while to see revenue, especially when funding at the super early stages. I mean, I guess from our perspective, where we are extremely valuation and ownership sensitive, we're oftentimes willing to withstand a significant period of time with relatively low revenue in exchange for building a great business in the long run. But I do think everything that Connor and Robin said was true around the fact that strategic capital partners are extremely important. and high valuations from compelling founders with compelling stories who come in with huge egos and are asking for a lot. That's definitely a huge problem that plagues not only our industry, but virtually all of technology and innovation-oriented industries. But this much-needed reshaping of the valuation landscape that's happened over the last couple of years has been really important and has been a really good thing. But I think also the point that a lot of these companies are ultimately going after the same customers. So, you know, there can only be so many winners, and you're going to see a lot of losers in the American market because we are ultimately all going after a similar set of customers. So while this is a team sport on some level and we're trying to grow the pie, there are going to be clear winners and losers, and there will be more losers inevitably.
All right, guys. We'll leave the topics around the Game Changers report there. Again, for anybody listening that wants to check out the report, have a look in the show notes. There is a link to it. It's free. You might as well check it out. If I may humbly suggest, it is quite an intriguing read. But I guess, guys, to take us home today, looking ahead to Q2, obviously we're, you know, a few days into Q2 here, but I'd love to get your guys' perspective on kind of what we can expect here. And I guess what's on my mind for today is, as consolidation continues at the operator level specifically, curious what you guys sort of think and see as being the downstream effects for industry startups. And as consolidation continues, you know, what would your top piece of advice be to entrepreneurs that are building in the space and adapting to the changing environment around them as, again, the concentration of power accrues to just a handful of startups, again, particularly from a U.S. market perspective? Any sort of top takeaways or pieces of advice you could dispense here today? Robin, maybe we'll start with you on this one.
So I agree with something Connor said earlier, that I think it's going to slow down a bit in Q2. I think you saw a lot of energy and appetite into the market going fresh into 2024, backed by AI, and I think it's going to slow down a bit. So I would advise startups to be more robust, focus on their bottom line, and make sure that your runway is stretched out as far as possible.
Yeah, so as well as investing in the gambling space, we also invest in the gaming space. And the reason we always liked investing in gaming is because, broadly speaking, it's 3 or 4 years ahead of most other industries. What we've seen there from a consolidation perspective, I think, for me, speaks very loudly where we're going to in the gambling industry, which is the simple math of consolidation is you're going to have less people to take you out as an acquirer. I think what that means is ultimately, as the acquirer universe shrinks on the one hand, competitive tension becomes less from an acquisition perspective. I think similarly, consolidation means that landing those tier ones become landing tier 0.5s and probably take even longer. And, you know, that in of itself becomes a greater challenge as well. So I think that while consolidation at the top end is challenging, there is also opportunity of consolidation kind of in that sort of starting to get to growth stage kind of businesses where, and we saw this, for example, with one of our portfolio companies, BetSports, who merged with Fantasy Life at the time. And that actually gave them the scale of user numbers to kick on and kind of get to where they've got to now. So I do think that there are opportunities that I don't think founders are exploring actively enough at the moment of actually finding scale by, you know, sort of having a beautiful love baby with someone else and actually, you know, using that as a bit of a solution to this challenge of consolidation of the incumbents.
Yeah, well, I think this consolidation is inevitable and it's already starting to take hold, but there is a period of time where, especially for some of these B2B service providers, and I made this point earlier, but kind of prove their products out on a smaller to mid-size scale. And then, I mean, if you don't find your way into the tier ones or tier 0.5s, you're not going to build a 9 or 10 figure business. It's just not possible. So at the end of the day, if there's a way in the door, whether that's through starting with a smaller partnership and expanding to a larger one, or whether that's biting the bullet and taking or finding some way to create a strategic relationship with a larger operator, which might ultimately lock them in as your only viable acquirer. But sometimes that's what needs to be done, better than having no business at all. So obviously being open to that kind of strategic alignment is important as well. So I think it's ideally you don't need to do that and you can just kind of play the field, but that's obviously something founders need to be open to.
Awesome, guys. We're going to wrap up today with one rapid fire question. This actually wasn't in our topic outline that I sent you. So we're going to fly by the seat of our pants here. Robin called it out earlier, the fact that every event that the Next.io team puts on, there's typically a predictions panel, which more often than not includes Robin on said predictions panel. So he's no stranger to making predictions. I want to ask each of you guys for your prediction. It can be outlandish, it can be fun, it can be whatever you want. I'm looking for a prediction on, you know, an M&A deal in the duration of calendar 2024 that might not be on anybody's bingo card. Is there anything random you guys can think of or fun that, you know, you think might not be on the radar that we can call out here as a prediction? And I'll put the floor open for anybody that wants to step up first to volunteer their answer to that one.
I'm happy to go. I think one thing that no one's really looking at the moment in terms of potential M&A is actually around what V2 of odds look like, particularly in the sports betting space. You know, I think you've got a lot of interesting businesses out there that are in and around that kind of $100 million mark that are really pushing, you know, to try and kick on to the 300, 400 million mark in the next year or two. And we've always thought once those sort of businesses, if they're able to get to 300, is when the likes of Genius and Radar, you know, start getting to the point where they have to seriously start thinking about finding ways to acquire them, albeit that not so easy for Genius at the moment, given their market cap. So my predictions would be that you're going to hear a pretty substantial acquisition from one of those two of a business you've probably never heard of.
All right. I like it. Robin, the prediction man himself, over to you for the next one here.
I think one of those Instagame providers, those crash game providers, going to get acquired for a lot of cash by one of the major game studios. Somebody just have to move into one of the innovative spaces.
I can see there being an acquisition around some sort of sports book personalization software. I know there's been a lot of focus on personalization and a lot of talk around that in the latter half of 23 going into this year. So I feel like any operator that integrates a high quality product that can serve customers what they're looking for when they're looking for it is going to be super successful. So I could see that happening in the back half of this year.
Awesome, guys. Final thing, if we can go around, if you guys can quickly mention where people listening can either submit their decks to or how they can reach you with their ideas, their opportunities, their deals. What's the quickest and best way for people to get that over to you? Connor, if you can start, please.
Yeah, sure. So info@venopartners.co.uk. Otherwise, you can reach out to myself or one of my team on LinkedIn. And yeah, we're very active there, similarly on Telegram.
You can go to ebergcapital.com/contact. We have a form over there that you can fill out and we're very responsive on that. Same goes for LinkedIn. You can find myself, Ethan, or my dad, Roger, on LinkedIn and reach out. And we're relatively quick there as well.
Send me an email at robin@fpower.io, robin@fpower.io. And, you know, you don't need to attach a deck or anything. Just tell me a little bit about yourself and why you're a good guy and why you're passionate about this. It's a good start.
Awesome, guys. Well, look, that takes us to the finish line today. So I want to thank all three of you for your time and participation. This was a great conversation, obviously a very busy Q1, and we'll look forward to seeing what Q2 brings. But we'll leave it there for today. And for everybody listening, really appreciate you tuning in as always. And we'll be back in 3 months with the next edition of the Investor Vibe Check. Thanks to everyone.
Thanks, Shafi.
Cheers.
The Betting Startups Podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming market. 4 out of the top 5 US operators personalize player experiences with Optimove. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/bettingstartups. And if you like what you see, you'll get your first month free.